Good morning, everybody. Happy New Year, and welcome to Sun Sounds of Arizona. The program is Business World, and I'm Steve Klein. We're going to start with an article that may run contrary to much of what you've been reading in the news. It's from Fortune magazine by Sasha Rogelberg, and you can believe this or you cannot believe it. At any rate, though, here is the article. Wages are actually growing faster than inflation. Here's why you don't believe it. With Zoran Mondami due to be sworn in as New York City mayor, and in a beautiful abandoned subway station, the year of affordability is being capped off fittingly. The K-shaped economy, with diverging prospects for the rich and poor, is the near consensus from economists. And yet, there's an inconvenient fact. Wages are going up. A lot. Apollo chief economist Torsten Slok noted in a Tuesday blog post that wages are growing faster than inflation, a pattern that's persisted for more than a decade, usually an indication of increased spending and productivity that can buoy the economy. When discussing affordability, it is important to note that while the CPI price level has increased 26% since 2019, wages have increased 30%, he said, citing data from the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics. Similar to Slok, Jason Furman, Harvard Kennedy School of Government professor and former chair of the Council of Economic Advisers under Obama, told CNBC's Squawk Box last week that strong wage growth bucks the trend of economic doom. He went so far as to say that consistently rising income weakens the argument that there's a lopsided K-shaped recovery of the rich getting richer while the poor get poorer. I'm less convinced about this K-shaped recovery than other people are, Furman said. Everybody wants prices to be 25% lower. Nobody wants their wages to be 25% lower. He added that gas prices are the cheapest they've been all year, which usually reflects well on the presidential administration. But Americans seem to disagree. In fact, they're feeling increasingly dour about their financial future, and consumer confidence has plummeted to its lowest level since April, even as GDP growth, which reached a lofty 4.3% last quarter, indicates an economic boom. But take a closer look, and the reasons that many Americans aren't convinced become clearer. Greater inspection of wage growth in the United States may reconcile why concerns over affordability have persisted in the face of objectively good economic news. Data from the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta indicates that while the quartile of the highest income Americans have seen their wage growth diminish slightly from 5.5% in 2023 to 4.5% now, those in the lowest income quartile have seen wage growth shrink from a high of 7.5% in 2022 to about 3.5% today, the lowest in about a decade. The inflation rate, as of November, is about 2.7%. A July report from the Indeed Hiring Lab found that wage growth sitting above inflation has increased purchasing power for some, but not all, Americans. In 2021's job market rebound, wage growth surged for lower-paying roles like food service and childcare workers, according to the report. But today, higher wage growth is correlated with higher-paying jobs, meaning that purchasing power increased for 57% of Americans in the last year, most of them higher earners. It's a return to the 2021 era job boom, but a worrying sign for lower wage employees. While this return to pre-pandemic levels is an encouraging sign for many American workers and their paychecks, it is sobering for 43% of workers who aren't keeping up. Indeed, Hiring Lab economist Corey Stable wrote in the report, "The generally rising tide of healthy wage growth is lifting most boats, but not all of them." Strong consumer spending patterns reflect this trend, according to a Bank of America report from December 22nd. Disparities in wage growth have correlated with household spending growth, with spending in the top third of income earnings increasing 4% year over year in November, and spending from the bottom third increasing less than 1% in the same period, the bank noted. Rather than wage growth and consumer spending contradicting the K-shaped economy, as Furman noted the data initially suggests, it may actually be a sign the two-tiered environment is here to stay. From a macroeconomic perspective, higher and middle-income household consumer spending accounts for the bulk of overall U.S. consumption, so the economy can continue to grow as a K for some time, Bank of America analysts wrote. Now we're going to talk about something that may sound contradictory to the previous article. The article's by Jason Ma. It's from Fortune magazine, dated December 30th. Negative prices for electricity are getting more common in Europe, and consumer costs have dipped, while Americans face rising energy bills. Electricity supply is increasingly outpacing demand in Europe as renewable energy capacity grows, making negative prices a more frequent occurrence. In early 2020, Spain's installed solar power capacity totaled nearly 9 gigawatts, according to data from Red Eléctrica. In early 2025, it had soared to 32 gigawatts, helped by subsidies. With solar panels and wind turbines installed in more places, while energy storage capacity is still lagging, an especially sunny and windy day can generate more electricity than is needed, sending prices below zero. By September, the number of hours in Spain with negative electricity prices had already topped 500 for the year to date, more than double the full year total for 2024. Similarly, France's hours had topped 400 by then, also exceeding its 2024 tally, and Germany was on trajectory to do so as well. Those rates are for the wholesale electricity market, meaning traders must pay someone to take the surplus energy instead of the other way around. That doesn't mean that households are also paid to consume electricity, because those rates are often set in advance. But negative prices can eventually be felt in markets with more dynamic pricing regimes. In fact, electricity prices for households in the European Union during the first half of the year were down 1.5% from the first half of 2024, according to data published in October. Excluding taxes Europeans paid, electricity prices fell more sharply and have been sliding since 2023, after spiking in 2021 and 2022. By contrast, rising electricity prices in the United States have become a growing source of voter discontent as utilities race to build more capacity to feed skyrocketing demand from AI data centers. The higher bills have fueled an overall affordability crisis that started with a post-pandemic inflation spike and was worsened by President Donald Trump's tariffs. While the annual inflation rate has cooled sharply since peaking in 2022, consumers are still reeling from the aggregate price hikes over the last 5 years and are demanding lower prices, not just slower increases. The latest Consumer Price Index data released earlier this month showed that electricity prices in November were up 6.9% year over year on an unadjusted basis. To be sure, negative electricity prices also happen occasionally in the United States, including in Texas, which has a more deregulated grid and significant wind power capacity. But the Trump administration is cracking down on renewable energy, gutting subsidies for solar power and killing wind energy projects, and negative prices in Europe aren't helping the energy industry there, as they weigh on producers' profits and valuations for solar plants. Countries are scrambling to boost battery storage, but in the short term, the challenging price environment has cooled development of new solar capacity, even where land permits and grid access have been secured. The market is flooded with ready-to-build projects that developers want to sell since they're no longer good enough in the current market, a senior executive at an owner of Spanish solar plants told the Financial Times. Okay, let's talk about the dollar. Here's an article from Fortune magazine and from Bloomberg, dated December 30th. The dollar set for the worst year since 2017, with the Fed drama center stage. The dollar is poised for its sharpest annual retreat in 8 years, and investors say more declines are coming if the next Federal Reserve chief opts for deeper interest rate cuts as expected. The Bloomberg Dollar Spot Index has fallen about 8% this year so far, after tumbling in the wake of Donald Trump's Liberation Day tariffs in April. The greenback came under sustained pressure as the president kicked off his aggressive campaign to get a dovish appointee installed as Fed chair next year. The biggest factor for the dollar in first quarter will be the Fed, said Yusuke Maori, a foreign exchange strategist at Nomura. And it's not just the meetings in January and February, but who will be the Fed chair after Jerome Powell ends his term, with at least 2 rate reductions priced in for next year. The U.S.'s policy path diverges from some of its developed peers, further dimming the dollar's appeal. The euro has surged against the greenback as benign inflation and a coming wave of European defense spending keep rate cut bets close to zero. In Canada, Sweden, and Australia, meanwhile, rate traders are wagering on hikes. The dollar gauge rose as much as 0.2% Wednesday after Labor Department data showed applications for U.S. unemployment benefits fell last week to one of the lowest levels this year. The greenback index was still on track to finish December down about 1%. This month, a brief period of bullish positioning on the dollar reverted to the more pessimistic stance that's dominated since the April tariffs fueled concerns about the U.S. economy. Commodities Future Trading Commission data for the week ending December 16th showed. For now, it's all about the Fed and who steps in to replace Jerome Powell, whose term as chair is set to end in May. Trump recently teased that he has a preferred candidate, but is in no hurry to make an announcement, while also musing that he might fire the central bank's current leader. National Economic Council Director Kevin Hassett has long been seen as a leading candidate, while Trump also expressed interest in former Fed Governor Kevin Warsh. Fed Governors Christopher Waller and Michelle Bowman and BlackRock's Rick Rieder are also seen as being in the running. Hassett would be more or less priced in, since he's been the front runner for some time now, but Warsh or Waller would likely not be as quick to cut, which would be better for the dollar, said Andrew Haslett, a foreign exchange trader at Monex Incorporated. It's very difficult to do an entire show without having at least one tariff article, so here's this week's offering. It's by Nick Lichtenberg from Fortune magazine, dated December 31st. $25,000 per month, the cost of Trump tariffs on small business importers revealed. A stark new economic analysis reveals the Trump administration's trade policies are extracting a heavy toll from Main Street, with small business importers paying approximately $25,000 more per month in tariff costs since April of 2025. The report, published December 17th by the Center for American Progress, CAP, a left-wing think tank, details how a chaotic approach to trade and the elimination of key import exceptions have created a financial crisis for entrepreneurs during the critical holiday season. According to the analysis by Michael Negron and Minda Wardak, the administration's Liberation Day tariff announcement triggered a sharp increase in duties collected from American businesses. From April through September 2025, CAP estimated, the roughly 236,000 small business importers in the United States paid an average of more than $151,000 in additional tariffs compared to the same period in 2024. CAP cited the Centrist Chamber of Commerce's research on the small business importer section of The Economy. The Trump administration's broad, costly, and frequently shifting policies threaten to undermine one of the strongest engines of the American economy, Negron said in a statement to Fortune. A season of opportunity for small businesses has turned into one of uncertainty. The burden is not limited to larger enterprises. The report found mom-and-pop businesses, those with fewer than 50 employees, paid on average over $86,000 more per business during the six-month window than they did the previous year. The outlook for the immediate future is equally grim. CAP projects that if current monthly costs persist, the typical small business will face a tariff bill exceeding $500,000 in 2026, potentially resulting in additional layoffs, bankruptcies, and delayed investments. For the holidays, CAP concludes the tariffs are a costly lump of coal in American small business collection. Beyond direct financial costs, small business owners are struggling with a sudden increase in bureaucratic red tape. The administration eliminated the de minimis exception, which previously allowed low-value shipments to enter the United States without duties or extensive paperwork. This policy change has forced businesses to prepay new tariff rates and complete complex customs forms for millions of shipments that were formerly exempt. Jyoti Jaiswal, founder of OM Sutra, a small business selling sustainable fashions and home goods, told CAP the changes have forced her to consolidate shipments and block more capital up front. Jaiswal noted her company now spends 10 to 15 hours on tariff-related administrative work per shipment, up from 8 to 10 hours previously, preventing her from passing costs on to consumers without losing competitiveness. Similarly, Legrand Lindor, CEO of LMI Textiles, told CAP his medical supply company went from spending zero time on tariff paperwork to spending 4 to 5 hours per transaction, facing a 20% increase in product costs, roughly $80,000 in additional spending. Linder was forced to scrap plans to open a new warehouse in 2025. The rising costs appear to be cooling the labor market for small firms. Data from payroll provider ADP shows that businesses with fewer than 50 employees laid off 120,000 workers in November 2025, the highest number of small business layoffs in 5 years. While the administration claimed foreign nations would pay these costs, the report emphasizes tariffs are taxes paid by American importers. Goldman Sachs calculated that of August 2025, businesses had absorbed 51% of the cost of tariffs, though they had passed 37% on to consumers through higher prices. A survey by Small Business Majority from late 2025 indicated 74% of small business owners are now worried about their businesses surviving the next 12 months. The tariff crisis coincides with other financial headwinds. The report highlights the expiration of enhanced Affordable Care Act premium tax cuts in 2026, threatens to double premiums for millions of entrepreneurs and small business employees. with the holiday season typically accounting for at least one quarter of annual revenue for retailers, the convergence of high tariffs and administrative confusion has delivered what the report describes as a decidedly unhappy holiday season for the nation's 236,000 small business importers. Without a change in policy, these businesses face the prospect of escalating costs and reduced investment heading into the new year. One of the largest issues of the tariff situation is whether China will in fact buy U.S. soybeans. Here's an article from Bloomberg and Fortune dated December 29th. The title of the article is China Buys Two-Thirds of Pledged U.S. Soybeans as 2025 Closes. China has bought at least 8 million tons of U.S. soybeans this year, according to people familiar with the matter. And by the way, I'd love to know who people familiar with the matter actually are, not just in this article, but in any article. You see a lot of that term. Okay, anyway, back to the article, putting the world's top importer on track to meet a pledge it made 2 months ago as part of an apparent trade truce with Washington. State-owned buyers have continued to book U.S. cargoes into late December, the people said, asking not to be named as they're not authorized to discuss the purchases. That extends a buying spree that began in October and maintains a pace that has reassured American exporters, otherwise wary that Beijing's commitment might slip amid limited visibility and unclear deadlines. The shipments booked so far are mostly for loading between December and March, the people said. The White House said immediately after talks between President Donald Trump and Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping that China had pledged to buy at least 12 million tons of U.S. soybeans by the end of the year. U.S. officials later clarified the deadline was in fact the end of February. Beijing has not confirmed the commitment, but the Chinese government has moved to reduce tariffs on the crop and lifted import bans on three American exporters. The return of Chinese buyers is welcome news for U.S. exporters and a reminder that buying patterns can change fast, but it is not yet a full reset. Even as Beijing takes U.S. shipments, state-owned firms have bought large quantities of beans from Brazil and Argentina, the people said. Commercial buyers, in particular, have stayed on the sidelines when it comes to U.S. purchases. Almost 80% of Brazil's soy went to China in 2025, with exports through November climbing 16% compared to the previous year. That trade continued in December, even in a period when sales are seasonally weaker, and Brazil's upcoming harvest is forecast to be a record. We cannot confirm from China's side that anything beyond the 12 million tons has been pledged, said Ben Buckner, grains and dairies analyst at Ag Resource Company. The brokerage wrote in a note this week that China was seeking shipments and could reach a soft target of 10 million tons in 2025, with an additional 2 million tons in January. Without a formal deal confirmed by both sides, traders say uncertainty over future sales is reinforcing pressure on soybean prices. Futures in Chicago eased in the year's final trading session Wednesday, on track to decline about 7% in December, the worst month performance since July 2024. Matt Bennett, an Illinois corn and soy farmer, said many farmers have been pleasantly surprised with a steady flow of purchases from China so far, but added there's also been frustration with the direction of soybean prices. From our vantage point, once you quantify that they're going to buy 12 million tons, you need something in excess of that to get everyone excited, Bennett, co-founder of farm advisory AgMarketNet, said in a phone interview. Trump earlier this month announced $12 billion in relief for U.S. farmers, but growers are still waiting for administration to provide details on how much they'll get in payments promised by February. We've recently done several articles on the rapid price increase of gold, silver, and platinum. Now we're going to talk about copper. This is from Fortune magazine in conjunction with Bloomberg, dated January 1st. Copper records the biggest annual gain since 2009 on supply bets. Copper had its best year since 2009, fueled by near-term supply tightness and bets that demand for the metal, key in electrification, will outpace production. The red metal has notched a series of all-time highs in an end-of-year surge, rallying 42% on the London Metal Exchange this year. That makes it the best performer of the six industrial metals on the bourse. Prices dipped 1.1% Wednesday, the last trading day of 2025. The latest gains also have been driven by traders rushing to ship copper to the United States in anticipation of potential tariffs, creating tightness elsewhere. Trump's plan to revisit the question of tariffs on primary copper in 2026 revived the arbitrage trade that rocked the market earlier this year, tightening availability elsewhere, even as underlying demand in key buyer China has softened. That price spread narrowed recently amid a power December rally on the London Metal Exchange. The expectation for future U.S. import tariffs on refined copper has resulted in more than 650,000 tons of metal entering the country, creating tightness in ex-U.S., wrote Natalie Scott Gray, senior metals analyst at StoneX Finance Limited. She noted two-thirds of global visible stocks are now held within COMEX. Beyond the tariff-driven flows, a deadly accident at the world's second-largest copper mine in Indonesia, an underground flood in the Democratic Republic of Congo, and a fatal rock blast at a mine in Chile have all added more strain to availability of the metal. The near-term outlook for copper demand growth has been clouded by weakness in China, the world's top consumer of the red metal. The country's property market has been stuck in a years-long downturn that's dented the need for copper plumbing and wiring, while consumer spending has been sluggish, weighing on appetite for finished goods such as electronic appliances. Still, robust momentum in global copper demand is expected over the long term. Bloomberg NEF estimates consumption could increase by more than a third by 2035 in its baseline scenario. The drivers of this trend include the ongoing shift to cleaner energy sources, such as solar panels and wind turbines, growing adoption of electric vehicles, and the expansion of power grids. Copper settled 1.1% lower at $12,558.50 a ton in London. Prices hit a record $12,960 on Monday. You rarely see much written about Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, yet they are an integral part of the housing market in the United States, which in turn is one of the major drivers of the overall economy. Here's an article on what privatizing the wrong way could mean. It's from Fortune magazine by Wesley Yin, and it's dated January 2nd. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are government-sponsored enterprises that play a central role in America's housing market. They buy qualifying mortgages from lenders, bundle them into mortgage-backed securities, and sell them to investors. This frees Main Street lenders to make new loans, keeping credit flowing and rates lower for home buyers. But excessive risk-taking by these enterprises helped bring about the 2008 crash and the Great Recession, leading them to be placed under federal conservatorship. This arrangement kept the enterprises solvent, transferring governance to the Federal Housing Finance Agency, and set operational guardrails to safeguard the stability of the housing market. Now, the Trump administration wants to reprivatize Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, indicating that an IPO could occur as early as the year's end, yet providing few policy details. This lack of transparency raises concerns that a hasty insider-driven exit from conservatorship will erode the safeguards that have kept the housing market stable, exacerbate systemic risks, and primarily enrich shareholders. Such a move would align the administration's agenda of rolling back financial regulations and oversight. Meanwhile, public pressure from shareholders to privatize and jockeying among investment banks to lead the IPO only heighten concerns that privatization will benefit wealthy investors over the public. The Trump administration says privatization will spur innovation and improve housing affordability. But if hastily done and without strong safeguards, it would do the opposite, raising borrowing costs for everyday Americans and encourage the type of risk-taking that fueled the Great Recession. There is no urgency to reprivatize Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. They've been operating successfully under conservatorship since 2008, and any eventual release from conservatorship should be deliberate, transparent, and grounded in the public's interest. Numerous design features would need to be resolved, but two components are absolutely essential: a government backstop for bad times and strong operational guardrails for good times. Together, these twin pillars can achieve systemic stability and support mortgage affordability. These twin pillars are tied directly to how the U.S. housing market operates. Investors readily buy Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac's mortgage-backed securities because they're guaranteed to receive payments, much like an insurance policy. To guarantee that they can make those payments to investors, even when there are defaults on the underlying mortgages, these enterprises in turn charge lenders a guarantee fee, which is mostly passed on to borrowers. If reserves prove insufficient during a major economic downturn, markets assume the U.S. government will bail out the enterprises, which are widely seen as too big to fail. But this same government backstop, vital especially in downturns, also encourages excessive risk-taking. Pre-recession, this implicit backstop allowed Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac to borrow cheaply, hold on to their mortgage-backed securities instead of selling them, and profit on spreads between homebuyer payments and their own low borrowing costs. That profit motive fueled risky behavior, loosened loan standards, large discretionary holdings of securities, and thin reserves. When the 2008 crisis hit, they quickly ran out of money, triggering the government bailout and conservatorship central to the current privatization debate. Reviving these profit opportunities is a key motivation behind reprivatization efforts to safeguard against excessive risk-taking and taxpayer bailouts. Conservatives have long advocated eliminating the government guarantee of a bailout. If that were to happen, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac would need to charge higher guarantee fees that fully reflect default risks. In theory, any excessively risky actions by these enterprises would result in higher guarantee fees, making their loans less attractive. Market discipline in action. But privatization in this way is dangerous. For one, this no-pillars privatization would raise borrowing costs because guarantee fees are passed on to borrowers. Daniel Hornung and Ben Sampson at Stanford estimate that typical borrowers would pay $5,000 to $2,000 more a year, even in stable economic conditions. The hike in costs would hit creditworthy lower-income borrowers the hardest. Second, during a financial crisis, risk-averse investors would pull back funding when it's needed most. Because housing is deeply tied to the broader economy, a housing credit crunch can spread and deepen a recession. In such times, government backing of mortgages bolsters investor confidence and stabilizes the housing market. That backstop was crucial in 2008, when it helped stabilize the housing market and the broader economy. In fact, the guarantee is so important to systemic stability that investors may not see its removal as credible. Third, privatization with a government backstop, even if implicit, still risks recreating the conditions that fueled the Great Recession. Any for-profit company that can borrow unlimited amounts of near risk-free debt would do so over time because it would maximize profits. Already, there are proposals to weaken reserve guardrails to boost profitability when reprivatized. This is why privatization without strong safeguards doesn't work. A government backstop is essential, but as long as investors expect one, the enterprises will still enjoy below-market borrowing costs and the same incentives for excessive risk-taking. Without sufficient guardrails and oversight, excessive risk-taking is not an if, but when. These are market failures that cannot be solved by market forces alone. To be sure, there have been thoughtful proposals that make shareholders absorb losses before taxpayers, which could help curb risky behavior. But investors often ignore long-term risks during good times, and systemic risks only become clear when it's too late, a lesson of the Great Recession. That's why strong oversight and strict guardrails on capital reserves, discretionary investments, executive pay, and broader mission are essential. After all, these are the very features that have made the conservatorship work. Taken together, the twin pillars of a government backstop and strong oversight and guardrails ensure liquidity and stability, and the resulting funding advantage enables the enterprises to sustain their affordable housing goals. Their below-market borrowing costs effectively subsidize all the loans they guarantee. But by pricing higher income loans closer to market rates, they generate profits that help expand mortgage access and lower costs for lower income home buyers, strengthening economic resilience. These outcomes are possible not in spite of the guardrails on profit taking, but because of them. While many other issues would also need to be resolved to end the conservatorships, these pillars must be the foundation. Without them, the risks of a second Great Recession are impossible to ignore. For our next article, we're going to talk about Warner Brothers and Netflix and Paramount again. The article is by Nick Lichtenberg. It's dated January 1st, and it's from Fortune magazine. The Netflix-Paramount saga caps a 2025 turning point, S&P says. Cable TV is in the decline stage with a long, slow bleed-out ahead. The American media landscape has officially crossed the Rubicon, according to S&P Global Market Intelligence's annual Economics of Basic Cable report from its Kagan Research Unit. It's a grim read. The U.S. cable network industry has formally entered the decline stage of its life cycle, a transition defined by falling revenues, shrinking viewership, and an unprecedented restructuring of legacy assets. While the sector faces a tough financial trajectory, the defining event is the high-stakes bidding war for Warner Brothers Discovery, where streaming giant Netflix and traditional powerhouse Paramount Skydance present two starkly different paths for the future of cable television. The inflection point identified in the 2025 report is not a sudden crash, but rather a structural dismantling of the cable bundle that dominated entertainment for decades. the WBD negotiations encapsulate this shift. While Paramount Skydance aims to acquire the company in its entirety, Netflix is bidding solely for WBD's film studio and streaming assets. Should Netflix prevail, WBD's cable assets would be split off, effectively stranding the linear networks as the industry leader cannibalizes the content engine for its digital platform. These decisions signify a shift in the media industry as companies abandon cable networks in favor of streaming services, wrote S&P's Scott Robson, who also noted that the burgeoning free ad-supported television, FAST, industry also continues to evolve as owners of library video content increasingly look for monetization outlets outside of basic cable syndication. Since the cord-cutting movement ushered in by Netflix gathered steam, Robson noted that linear network TV has been under pressure. Subscriptions peaked all the way back to 2012. Looking back at 2025 now, he concluded, there's no comeback in sight. This potential fracturing of WBD mirrors broader industry movements. Comcast is set to finalize the spin-off of its cable networks, excluding Bravo, into a standalone entity named Versant on January 2, 2026. These strategic exits signal that major media conglomerates are now willing to abandon cable networks in favor of streaming services, a trend accelerated by the August 2025 launches of the ESPN Unlimited and Fox One streaming platforms, according to S&P. The financial data underpinning this migration is stark. In 2024, gross advertising revenue for cable networks fell 5.9% to $20.2 billion, the lowest level recorded since 2007. Robson's team also estimated that affiliate fee revenue, or what TV operators pay to carry cable operators, fell nearly 3% to roughly $38.7 billion. Perhaps most telling is a subscriber metric. The average cable network saw its subscriber base erode by 7.1% to 31.4 million homes. However, S&P emphasized that this decline stage forecasts a long, slow bleed-out rather than a precipitous fall. After digesting all the major events that took place in 2025, it's clear that the industry has reached a turning point, Robson wrote. That being said, our outlook does not call for a major collapse, but rather a continued slow decline as the transition to streaming develops. S&P noted that despite the overarching downward trend, the rate of pay TV subscription decline appeared to slow in 2025, with the industry actually registering slight subscriber growth in the third quarter. Operators are attempting to manage this descent by clinging to the industry's last reliable life raft, live sports. The year 2026 looms large, featuring both the Winter Olympics and the FIFA World Cup. Comcast has even relaunched NBCSN, packing it into a sports-centric bundle on YouTube TV to capture viewers who haven't yet migrated to its Peacock streaming service. A separate S&P analysis concluded that sports may no longer be a moat for the declining linear TV business. Live sports may not be the anchor that once kept consumers from cutting the video cord, S&P's Keith Nissen wrote. Nissen cited an S&P survey that found 90% of households dropping traditional pay TV for sports over the past year were sports fans, and nearly two-thirds of them spent 5 hours or more per week watching sports. This serves as evidence that access to live sports is no longer a differentiator between traditional and virtual multi-channel services. Robson warned that the friction between rising costs and falling value has intensified, with 2025 marred by carriage disputes, including blackouts of Walt Disney and Televisa Univision networks on YouTube TV, as distributors pushed back against rising prices for diminishing audience. As 2026 approaches, the industry outlook is one where underperforming networks face relegation to expensive tiers or outright closure. The situation is akin to an estate sale for a once grand mansion. The owners, media conglomerates, are systematically selling off the furniture, cable networks, and moving the most valuable heirlooms, premium content, and sports rights into a modern apartment across town, streaming, leaving the old house to slowly empty out room by room. The next article is from Fortune magazine. It's by Adam Cecil, dated December 30th. How Warren Buffett's Geico fell behind Progressive in the auto insurance race. Warren Buffett's failure to capitalize on the economy's digital shift over the last two decades has hurt his otherwise enviable track record as an investor. His blind spot regarding tech didn't stop at the stock market. It bled into how he ran Berkshire Hathaway's operating companies as well. Across many of his wholly owned businesses, Buffett neglected technological upgrades, and Berkshire's business value has suffered as a result. It's important to understand this because the majority of Berkshire Hathaway's assets are invested not in publicly traded securities, but in operating subsidiaries like Burlington Northern, Santa Fe Railroad, Berkshire Hathaway Energy, and Geico. While it's true that Buffett invested aggressively in wind energy, that was largely because of government tax incentives. In the main, he preferred to milk his operating subsidiaries for cash rather than reinvest in them for the digital age. Exhibit A is Geico, which, thanks to a lack of IT investment, has fallen behind Progressive as the nation's leading for-profit auto insurer. Buffett has called Geico his favorite child, and for good reason, since it began in the 1930s. The auto insurer has used a direct sales model to keep operating costs the lowest in the industry. In a commodity business like insurance, that's a major competitive advantage. In the 1990s, after he bought all of Geico, Buffett founded a second moat when he began to brand Geico as a trusted, even beloved American company. The gecko, the caveman, the camel who celebrated hump day. All these were marketing masterstrokes, ones directly derived from Buffett's deep understanding of the mass brand mass media industrial complex. The mascots also highlight how, while Buffett was comfortable investing in marketing, he was deeply uncomfortable with, and therefore didn't understand, investing in tech. When Buffett took control of Geico in 1996, he octupled its marketing budget. This wiped out almost all of Geico's profits from a GAAP accounting standpoint. But Buffett was confident that increasing advertising outlays today would lead to more profitable customers tomorrow. And so it was. Under Buffett's leadership, Geico's market share grew from under 3% in 1996 to 12% in 2020. And it went from the number 7 auto insurer to the number 2 auto insurer, behind only State Farm. So far, so good. But while Geico was investing in marketing, its rival Progressive was investing in technology. Founded only a year after Geico, Progressive began to upgrade its IT systems as early as the late 1970s. In the 1980s, it bought its agents' computers and sent them floppy disks so they could better match price with risk. In 1996, Progressive became the first auto insurer to allow consumers to buy insurance online, and it continually streamlined its back-end systems so it could accurately quote new business. Today, Progressive brags that it has tens of billions of price points and that its tech stack allows the company to adjust its rates much faster than its competition, nearly once every business day. We are a tech company that happens to sell insurance. is one of Progressive's internal mantras. Driving the company's tech investment was an insight that perhaps even more astute than Buffett's marketing insight. Thanks to its no-agent, no-commission model, GEICO enjoyed a 6 percentage point cost advantage versus Progressive in its operating costs. Because half of its business is through insurance agents, Progressive is unlikely to ever catch up here. But Progressive CEO Peter Lewis, who led the company from 1965 to 2000, understood that an auto insurer's biggest cost center is the claims it must pay to policyholders, 4 to 5 times bigger, in fact, than its administrative and advertising costs. Progressive could manage these loss costs better than the competition, Lewis reasoned. Then it could become the de facto low-cost auto insurer. The key to managing loss costs was technology in all its glorious variety. Back-end systems at headquarters that could parse price and risk for each driver were important, but so were frontline innovations like Snapshot, a shoebox-sized device that in the 1990s Progressive began installing into the cars of willing customers. Snapshot, now an app on your mobile phone, tracks a customer's driving behavior. More than 1 in 3 Progressive customers buying insurance directly from the company opts for its usage-based premiums. Thanks to Snapshot and other innovations, Progressive simply knows more about its drivers than any other insurer. And this creates a virtuous circle in which the company knows which to reward with discounts, which to punish with surcharges, and which to purge altogether. Thus, while Progressive's operating costs have historically been 6 points worse than GEICO, its loss costs have been 11 points better, which means that GEICO's low-cost moat has been breached by tech. In contrast to Progressive's streamlined system, GEICO has more than 600 legacy IT systems. It didn't start working on a Snapshot-like product until 2019, 20 years after Progressive began. Buffett liked to say that when the tide goes out, you see who's swimming naked. And COVID was the perfect storm to reveal how little GEICO had paid attention to its digital wardrobe. During COVID, people suddenly stopped driving. And then, when the pandemic ended, they drove more than ever, and more recklessly than ever. At the same time, the worst inflation in 40 years hit all sectors of the economy, including auto repair shops. Such rapidly changing conditions favored insurers with robust tracking tools like Progressive, and punished insurers without them like GEICO. Since 2020, Progressive has almost doubled its personal auto policy count, but GEICO has lost nearly 15% of its personal insurance base. Progressive, not GEICO, is now the nation's number 2 auto insurer. It turns out that while the branding of the Gecko was important, it wasn't nearly as powerful as employing sophisticated digital tools. GEICO is a good example of what happens when a company, even a powerful one, fails to reinvest in its future. Rather than a virtuous cycle, tech investment leading to better pricing and better products, which drives more profits, which can then be reinvested to drive the cycle on. GEICO seems caught in the same vicious cycle that afflicts General Motors, Macy's, and other legacy companies. Here's an article from Fortune by Jim Edwards. It's titled, "The Stock Market is Barreling Toward a Show Me the Money Moment for AI and a Possible Global Crash." AI is a bubble, and everyone says so, including OpenAI's Sam Altman, who said recently, "I do think some investors are likely to lose a lot of money. The problem is that the Magnificent Seven tech companies are pouring $400 billion-plus annually into CapEx build-out for AI, far exceeding the revenues of the actual AI companies themselves." 75% of the stock market's gains came from the Mag 7, Alphabet, Amazon, Apple, Meta, Microsoft, NVIDIA, and Tesla. But their cap is funding about 10 much smaller private AI companies, which are largely unprofitable, creating an unstable inverted pyramid of equity. And yet, Wall Street analysts say CapEx for AI will continue unabated in 2026, while most analysts expect the S&P 500 to rise next year. This sustained spending on AI will intensify the pressure for a show-me-the-money moment. If AI revenues fail to justify the massive investment, it could trigger a severe and widespread global market correction. Our final article of the day is from Fortune by Saladitya Ray. Tesla is no longer the world's biggest EV maker. Tesla lost the crown of the world's biggest EV maker to China's BYD for the first time as the company's shares slipped on Friday after reporting a 16% decline in the deliveries of the final quarter of 2025, ending the year with 600,000 fewer deliveries than its Chinese rival. Here are the key facts of the article. Its fourth quarter production report, the company said it manufactured 434,358 vehicles and delivered 418,220 in the fourth quarter of 2025, a 16% decline compared to the same period in 2024. The number of deliveries fell short of Wall Street estimates of 426,000. Tesla said it delivered 1.63 million cars in 2025, down by more than 8.5% from the previous year. On Thursday, China's BYD reported that its EV sales rose 28% last year to 2.26 million units, beating Tesla's annual sales for the first time ever. BYD had fallen just short of Tesla's numbers last year, reporting 1.76 million units compared to the American carmaker's 1.79 million. Tesla's stock fell over 3% on Friday afternoon, continuing a streak of losses over the last 5 days of trading, in which shares have tumbled over 10%. Folks, that's all we have time for. This is Sun Sounds of Arizona. The program is Business World, and I'm Steve Klein. Thank you so much for listening. See you next Monday at 11.